content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue. The first article is from Teen Vogue's OG History series, and it's titled, The Story Behind the St. Louis Race Riots. This article was written by Jen M. Jackson, and it was published back in October 16th of 2017. This is a story about how Black American residents of a small industrial city in Illinois endured 3 days of violence and horror that have scarcely shown up in the pages of our history books. The East St. Louis race riot of 1917 saw the indiscriminate massacre of men, women, and children in a one-sided spate of brutal burnings of people and buildings, lynchings, shootings, and beatings that left an official death toll of 39 Black and 9 white Americans dead, though historians estimate that more than 100 Black people were actually killed. The conflict started on July 1st of 1917, when 2 white male plain-clothed officers were shot dead by armed Black residents in East St. Louis, Illinois, the sister city to St. Louis, Missouri, which falls just over the state line. The officers were driving in a Ford Model T, which many Black residents mistakenly believed carried white drive-by shooters who had been terrorizing Black people of the neighborhood. Black residents armed themselves to defend their community from members being killed, but their intentions did not protect them, as whites in the town retaliated for the deaths of the 2 officers who were mistakenly killed in a racist massacre that took over the following 2 days. On July 3rd, Carlos F. Hurd, a staff reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, published the earliest and gruesome reports out of the area. He reported that many white Americans, often dressed in suits and house clothes, roamed the streets looking for Black residents to terrorize. He was even shocked by the calmness of their demeanor as they brutally killed Black people. These weren't drunken, dispassionate rabble-rousers. They were working people who were killing Black people for fun. And they were doing so in the most sickening of ways. Hurd noted that the term mob didn't quite make sense with the scene at hand. A mob is passionate. A mob follows one man or a few men blindly. A mob sometimes takes chances, he wrote. The East St. Louis affair, as I saw it, was a manhunt, conducted on a sporting basis. I saw one of these men, covered with blood and half conscious, raise himself on his elbow and look feebly about, when a young man standing directly behind him lifted a flat stone in both hands and hurled it upon his neck, Hurd wrote. Philosopher W.E.B. Du Bois called the riots the Massacre of East St. Louis in the September 1917 edition of the official publication of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, The Crisis. He detailed accounts of babies that were snatched from their mothers' arms and thrown into flames, and shared that some Black Americans were trapped in their homes and businesses as the buildings were set on fire. Other accounts tell of execution-style shootings as Black people fled their homes in fear. Like most large-scale racial tensions in the U.S., the East St. Louis riots were rooted in systemic inequality, rather than the interpersonal animus credited with their spark. The area of East St. Louis had become a mecca for Black Americans, both fleeing the Jim Crow South and seeking opportunities for economic prosperity in the booming World War I trade and production industries. Thousands of Black people from the South moved north to work in war factories. East St. Louis's Black population, 6,000 strong in 1910, nearly doubled by 1917, according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. These growing populations not only brought with them skills and desire for mobility, but a new sense of power and collective numbers that created tense competition for employment, housing, and public resources in the city. In fact, the city was a hotbed for racial tension and violence before the riots. For years preceding July 7, 1917, East St. Louis endured political antagonism between white machine political leaders who were threatened by growing Black votes and political influence in the city. When white political leaders and their allies again failed to secure the power over the growing Black population, in East St. Louis, the more terror and violence. In American Pogrom, the East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics, historian Charles L. Lumpkins explains that during this historical moment in the city, certain political businessmen decided to employ mass racial violence to eliminate the threats that they perceived from rapid shifts in East St. Louis's political culture between 1915 and mid-1917. While no deaths were recorded at that time, there was a significant outbreak of racial terror on May 28th of the same year after white laborers, feeling threatened by Black migration to the area, lodged a formal complaint to the town mayor. When rumor spread about an attempted robbery by an armed Black man, a rumor that remained uncorroborated, white mobs formed and began beating Black residents at random and pulling them off of trolley cars and streetcars. The National Guard had to be called in to end the violence. The brutality on this day was only a prelude to what would happen that July. By the end of the July massacre, nearly $400,000 worth of damage had been done, which would be about $7 million today. But the true toll of the East St. Louis race riots had nothing to do with money. The deeper, more insidious fact underlying this event is that even though these horrors were vile and inhumane, this event and the lives lost have been mostly forgotten. Like generations of race riots in this country, these accounts paint a picture of racial terror orchestrated and carried out by white Americans against people of color who try to protect themselves in the face of threat. These pogroms, violence and riots meant to target a particular ethnic group, are rarely described as such to define massacres of indigenous people and Black Americans. Just because these histories are forgotten does not mean that we don't experience and relive them in different ways. Many of the same struggles for political freedom, recognition, and autonomy that were alive in 1917 still exist today. East St. Louis is a 20-minute drive from Ferguson, Missouri, the city where Michael Brown was shot and killed by then-officer Darren Wilson in August of 2014. Findings from the Ferguson Commission, a group appointed by Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to investigate the pre-existing racial tensions between black residents and police, suggested that all these decades later, St. Louis is still suffering under the effects of its long history of racial inequality and animus. With East St. Louis being just a short distance from Brown's hometown, there is no question that it is affected by the history and current conditions that shaped the lived experiences of black Ferguson residents today. Unfortunately, East St. Louis is not unique. There are sites of persistent racial trauma all over the country, traumas we have yet to fully expose and confront. By understanding and unearthing this history, we may come to terms with the never-ending struggle of justice for black Americans and the fights we have yet to face in the United States. The next article is titled, Megan Rapinoe called anti-trans sports bans cruel and disgusting in an interview highlighting equality. This article is written by Brittany McNamara and was published June 21st of 2022. Megan Rapinoe has been an incredibly influential advocate for equity in sports, recently helping lead U.S. women's soccer toward equal pay. But as the anniversary of the Title IX approaches, Rapinoe told Time that the 1972 legislation prohibiting discrimination based on sex in schools hasn't meant total equality for all student athletes, particularly for transgender young people. While Rapinoe called Title IX transformational legislation, she also noted that it likely has the same blind spots that exist in society. I'm sure there's a racial blind spot. I'm sure there's an LGBTQ blind spot. I'm sure there's an immigrant blind spot. All of that, she said. Title IX is also charged with handling sexual assault and rape on college campuses. We know that that is continuing to be rampant and underreported. As states across the country propose and pass legislation barring transgender students from school sports, Rapinoe said these laws aren't about athletics. They're about people's lives. I think people also need to understand that sports is not the most important thing in life, right? Life is the most important thing in life. And so much of this trans inclusion argument has been put through the extremely tiny lens of elite sports, she said. Like, that is not the way that we need to be framing this question. We're talking about kids. We're talking about people's lives. Currently, 18 states banned transgender girls and women from sports teams that aligned with their gender, according to NBC News. Trans youth are dying by suicide because they're being told that they're gross and different and evil and sinful, and they can't play sports with their friends that they grew up with, Rapinoe said. Not to mention trying to take away health care. I think it's monstrous. According to the Trevor Project's 2022 National Survey on LGBTQ Youth Mental Health, 45% of the nearly 34,000 LGBTQ youth surveyed said they seriously considered suicide in the past year. While there's no one reason anyone considers suicide, the survey showed that trans and non-binary youth who were supported were less likely to have suicidal ideation. And the report found that anti-trans legislation has influenced young LGBTQ people's mental health. Of the transgender and non-binary youth surveyed, 83% say they've worried about trans people being denied the ability to play sports because of anti-trans legislation. Recent political attacks aimed at transgender and non-binary youth have not only threatened their access to healthcare, support systems, and affirming spaces at school, they've also negatively impacted their mental health, Jonah DeChance, a research scientist at the Trevor Project, said in the report. Rapinoe also pointed out that banning trans students from sports teams isn't based on evidence. While legislators say these laws are to protect the integrity of athletics, Rapinoe said inclusion doesn't threaten integrity. Show me the evidence that trans women are taking everyone's scholarships, are dominating in every sport, are winning every title. I'm sorry, it's just not happening, she said. In an April video for the Human Rights Campaign, Skylar Baylor, former Harvard swimmer and the first trans man to compete in any NCAA D1 sport, debunked the myth that trans women have an inherent advantage in sports by noting that biological differences exist among all people, including cisgender women and men. Baylor pointed to Michael Phelps, whose long wingspan, torso, and feet propelled him to be the most decorated Olympian of all time. And Baylor noted that protecting women's sports means protecting it for all women. They think that if they use this feminist argument for protecting women, that you will think you're doing the right thing. But the reality is, if you want to protect women, you have to protect all women, transgender women included, Baylor said. To do anything else, Megan Rapinoe said, is unacceptable. So we need to start from inclusion, period, she said. And as things arise, I have confidence that we can figure it out. But we can't start at the opposite. That is cruel. And frankly, it's just disgusting. The next article is titled, Supreme Court EPA decision will accelerate climate change. This op-ed argues that the Supreme Court just gave a free pass to polluters. It's written by John Paul Mejia and was published July 1st, 2022. On June 27th, a city worker in San Antonio heard a cry for help from a tractor trailer abandoned on a desolate road. He followed the haunting cry, leading him to a horrific scene. More than 50 migrants lay dead or dying in the sweltering heat, reportedly covered in steak seasoning in what authorities said may have been an attempt to hide the stench. 48 people died in that trailer, and another 5 were in the slow process of dying. After hearing the news, I was unable to sleep. I couldn't stop thinking of how brutal the future of my people could be on a hotter planet. Higher temperatures will cause more deaths, and drought and other extreme weather will create even more refugees as people leave homes that are no longer livable. As a Latino kid born and raised in Miami, I've known about the threats of a warming world for as long as I've been alive. I remember the fear I felt as a toddler when the roaring winds of Hurricane Katrina made steel structures sway in the building where I lived with my mother. In high school, Hurricane Irma barreled through Miami, hitting poor, black, and brown communities the hardest. In the aftermath of that storm, the wealthy white kids got power back in their homes far sooner than I did. I felt worthless in the eyes of a government that claimed to represent me. On Thursday, I woke up to a headline that conjured this familiar feeling. In West Virginia v. the Environmental Protection Agency, the Supreme Court sided with fossil fuel executives over our communities and delivered a 6-3 ruling that severely limits the agency's power to fight the climate crisis. The ruling held that a section of the Clean Air Act can no longer be used to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from existing coal and gas-fired power plants. The EPA cannot, without explicit congressional approval, establish nationwide standards to limit greenhouse gas emissions, like carbon dioxide, forcing utilities to switch to renewable energy sources. The story of how we got here begins decades ago. In the 20th century, as a response to massive wins by social movements like the civil rights, environmental, labor, and feminist movements, a dangerous right-wing alliance of corporate executives and white supremacists began a decade-long project to reverse the progress won. They formed a coalition to dismantle their common enemy, democracy. They aimed to take over the Republican Party, exploit loopholes in the Constitution, and use stolen power to force everyone back into their nightmare world. After decades of following this playbook, this movement has hijacked the Supreme Court and turned it into a corporate-friendly, anti-democratic death cult. In many ways, the success of this movement takes us back in time to where women and birthing people have no rights over their bodies, back to a time when black political power is diluted, back to a time when Christian fundamentalists can persecute those who don't believe what they do. But the extreme right-wing isn't just taking us back to the 1950s. They're taking us somewhere we've never been before. We have precious few years to confront the climate crisis, and the unelected extremists on the Supreme Court are trying to obstruct some of the only avenues we have for our progress. What's worse is that leaders of the Democratic Party, who control the White House, Senate, and House of Representatives, seemingly have no plan but to write some vague tweets and surrender. One week ago, I went to see legendary labor organizer Dolores Huerta speak at a press event hosted by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus outside of the Capitol. Unexpectedly, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi showed up. I approached her and asked her how young voters could trust her after she supported Henry Cuellar, a fossil fuel-friendly politician who happens to be the last anti-choice Democrat in the House, over his primary challenger, Jessica Cisneros, a young Latina who was a pro-choice climate champion. I didn't get an answer, but I did get a polite, "have a nice day" from the bodyguard, who pushed me away from her. The politicians of Pelosi's era, like President Biden, remain committed to a fantasy that they can negotiate with Republicans, and that arcane Senate traditions are more important than taking the necessary action that will keep people safe and improve lives. It is clear that they are wrong. In response to the draconian rulings by a stolen Supreme Court, Democrats need to wake up and respond at the scale demanded by the crisis unfolding with our climate and democracy. First, Democrats should defy and circumvent a court whose legitimacy is dead. To defend democracy and our planet, the Biden administration and congressional Democrats should double down on their commitments to climate action. That means Congress must abolish the filibuster and enact sweeping climate legislation, and Biden must use the full extent of his executive powers to justly transition our country to 100% renewable energy. There are things we can do right now, from further invoking the Defense Product Act to expedite the transition to renewables, declaring a climate emergency, and ending the practice of selling leases for public lands and waters for fossil fuels production that would begin to tackle this crisis. Second, Democrats must clean up the courts. Half of the conservative justices were appointed by a president who lost the popular vote. Many of these justices were backed by nefarious dark money groups, and the spouse of one, Clarence Thomas, was affiliated with the January 6th insurrection. Democrats must expand the court and appoint justices that with proven track records of defending civil and constitutional rights. All justices, old and new, should be held accountable to a binding code of ethics. Democrats have a mission before them, and so do we. The only way we are going to build a true democracy that can keep the people and places we love safe is by building a movement powerful enough to take on the extreme, violent, and ascendant right wing. They want us to feel worthless and like nothing will ever change. We cannot let them. Our generation must rise to this moment in history and fight. Our lives depend on it. And finally, 7 Ways to Manage Climate Anxiety. This is written by Daniel Renwick, published October 6th of 2021. This piece originally appeared in Nexus Media, and it is republished here with permission. If you're scared, sad, confused with what's happening or by governmental inaction, it's a natural, healthy response. And I'll briefly cover some of what's in here. So the seven ways to manage climate anxiety. Stop doom scrolling. Yes, it's important to arm yourself with facts, but there is such a thing as too much information. At the end of the day, if you're well informed about the state of our climate, you know what we need to do about it. Then that 24/7 access to information is not really helping you. Number 2, remember, it's okay to feel this way. If you're scared, sad, confused with what's happening or by government inaction, it's a natural, healthy response. Number 3, find your community. Find your political home. Absent any sort of politics, finding your people can turn into a kind of funeral where you're just holding each other through the grief. Number 4, but don't be afraid to go it alone. If there's a specific thing in your community that you think are wasteful and bad for the environment, then you don't need to wait for someone else to take initiative. Start your own. Number 5, take care of yourself. Some people feel climate change is so urgent that they can't take a break, but you can't stay in it for a long haul unless you're replenishing yourself in the process. Number 6, but also call your representative. Right now, the most important climate bill, the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill in the history of our country, is several orders of magnitude and is on a knife's edge. And then number 7, we don't know how bad it's going to get, and that's all right. Fatalism is the easy posture of people that don't want to look reality in the face. We're going to have to keep fighting for the people, the things, and the values we love forever. All right, we have come to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.